Welcome to the Seen Gene Podcast. I'm Matthew Jaber Stifler, Research and Content Manager at the Arab American National Museum. The Seen Gene Podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies in the Arab American National Museum. Joining us today is Safia El-Hillo. Safia is the author of two books of poetry and a novel in verse, Home is Not a Country, which was longlisted for the National Book Award and is a 2022 Arab American Book Award winner. Her first book, The January Children, was also an Arab American Book Award winner. Although Safia does not identify as Arab, she writes a lot from her experiences as being from the Arabic-speaking world. Sudanese by way of Washington, D.C., Safia received the 2015 Brunel International African Poetry Prize and was listed in Forbes Africa's 2018 30 Under 30. Her work appears in Poetry Magazine, Kalalu, and the Academy of American Poets Poem a Day series, among others, and in anthologies including The Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip Hop, and The Penguin Book of Migration Literature. Her work has been translated into several languages and commissioned by Under Armour, Guyana, and the Bavarian State Ballet. With Fatima Oscar, she is co-editor of the anthology Halal If You Hear Me. Her fellowships include a Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation, Cave Canon, and a Cave Canum.
Cave Canum.
Thank you. And a Wallace Stegner Fellowship from Stanford University. Safia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I think we can start with, if you want to do a brief reading from your new book, Girls That Never Die, and then we'll head into a conversation after that.
Great. I think I am going to read the very first poem in the book, which I think feels like a good introduction. It's called Final Weeks, 1990, and it came from a prompt given to a group of us in workshop by Louise Glick, where she challenged us to write a poem that took place on the day of our birth, in which the time of year and the time of day must be evident somewhere in the poem. Final Weeks, 1990. Hours before, the night outside is black as my grandmother's hair. It's newborn moon in Sagittarius. And in the Maryland house, my mother is 23 behind a winning hand of cards as the water darkens the length of her skirt. December now, and friends still call her Al-Arus, the bride, 11 months married and the shock of it not yet settled behind her eyes. Morning and the baby has not come. Milky winter sun in Sagittarius. I should mention there was a husband, 27. I can hardly imagine it, a boy that age. My father. I cannot picture him in the room, though his work for years to come will absorb him into countries that smell of blood. Maybe he is in the room now, not yet a specter. I sketch him in, but do not know where to put him. Maybe in the corner, back rigid against the white wall. I cannot imagine them ever touching. I smudge him out, correct the still wet scene. He is outside. Long-limbed in a hard plastic chair. My mother called him Jack, and this is my only proof they were in love. My mother is almost my mother now, darker color of the noontime sun. In the waiting room, I should also place my grandparents, elegant in that old, over-formal way of immigrants. My grandfather's shirt never without a collar, lush neatness of the afro against his head. My grandmother could pass for a film star, hair black and feathered down her back, any suggestion of curl or coil since burnt away and set every morning in hot rollers. Her eyebrows tattooed as they have been all my life, blue-black parentheses, both of them older than the independent state of the Sudan. My grandmother 13 years its senior, my grandfather a January child of unknown birthday, though the colonial offices recorded as 26 years before his country is born. They are placid companions. Their courtship cooled amicably into a sort of siblinghood. And I have never seen them touch, so I cannot imagine it now. He paces the cool length of the hallway. 1 hour and 39 minutes past noon, that final diluvian push and I am outside, full head of wet hair, pomegranate creature cawing that little animal sound, pronounced a girl and named for a dead great aunt, the birth certificate dated and signed in ink. Back home, I would have been known by my first two names, mine and my father's, Safia Yaqub, the surname rarely used, but in the new country, the paper demands a patronym. Anglicized, the L becomes a looser L. Hello, meaning sweet, strange, unserious allonym of that first great-grandfather, and crowded together on a single line, marked first name, our names, mine and his, Safia Yaqub. Little echo of that forgotten epithet, that once-loved man, of Jack. And though I am not named for my mother, we match, Safa, noun form of my adjective, our shared first syllable, closest I have ever seen them, him and her, almost touching.
Thank you for that. And that opens the book, Girls That Never Die, which is a wonderful book of poetry that has a lot of repeating themes, repeating forms. Why did you choose to open with that poem, other than it being about your birth, which I guess is a logical place to start, but why choose that one to begin the book?
First, yes, the obvious reason of it starting with my birth, but also this is my second book of poems. This feels almost obvious to say, but it was the first time I had spent time working on a book that was not my first book of poems, if that makes sense. That book was like The January Children had kind of occupied so much of my life and my thinking for so many years, and then it was done. But a lot of the poetry that I was writing for years to come was still kind of in like the shadow of The January Children, you know, or like little aftershocks for just some of my obsessions in that book. And this poem kind of feels like a bridge between that book and this book, where that is a book that's very much obsessed with a particular kind of history and a particular kind of way of looking at the past. And I wanted to honor that and to thank it and also not take it too deep into this book. So this poem feels like an opening and a closing in that way.
So a couple of things come up in this opening poem that to me are themes that you find not just throughout this book, but through previous writing. And that is around naming, and especially your name. Why are you so fascinated with not your name, but where it comes from and how you got it, and also imagining different names? I see it come up. It's in your previous book. I've heard it in some of your earlier work as well.
Yeah. So in this book in particular, I am a woman whose name means pure. Things are not chill. Nothing is okay. So a lot of the meditation around naming in this particular book has to do with just the burden of that particular assignment and the kind of impossibility and violence of that designation, which I don't think was anyone's intention when they gave me that name. But unfortunately for those people, I grew up to be a very neurotic person. And so I can't help but meditate on the meaning of the name Safia and how the idea of purity just governs so much of the ways in which I was socialized as a girl and as a woman. So that was kind of just very, I don't know, like fertile metaphorical ground to spend time in for this book. For Home Is Not a Country, that whole project began with a poem that's actually in Girls That Never Die, a poem called Yasmin, which is just meditating on the fact that I was almost named Yasmin. One of the particular manifestations of my diasporic experience has just been like a fascination with alternate lives and alternate timelines and the ways in which things would have been different if only this like foundational rupture in my family history had never happened. And because I also know that I was almost given another name, I had kind of an avatar to assign all of this what if to. So the name thing does keep coming back. It just feels like such a like tidy container for so much meaning for me and so much of the ways in which things may or may not be predetermined based on what your name is and how that might kind of just like affect the weather in your life to come in some way.
Have you ever had a point in your life where you went by a different name? Or did you ever think of like writing under a different name?
No, sometimes I wish I did, because I really just do be putting my actual business in the world. And if I had a pen name, maybe my life would be easier. I started writing poetry when I was a teenager and I was on a youth slam team. And so I kind of, for as long as I've had a relationship to writing poems, I've had a relationship to reading them out loud to people. But I didn't know anything about this world until I was already like neck deep in it. So I didn't even know you could use a name that wasn't your government name. And by the time it occurred to me, it was too late. So in hindsight, it might have been a good idea to go by a different name, but I did not understand my options at the time. So I have just gone by Safia this whole time.
Well, since you brought it up that you do put a lot out there, a lot of your work, I mean, all the work that I've read, it seems very autobiographical, whether or not it is. The narrator makes it seem like this is the author's life. Lots of pain, lots of truth. Have you ever written something and then after you wrote it, you're like, oh no, that's never going to see the light of day. Like, cause it almost seems like you're willing to take chances and put things out there that like most people might not, but is there a limit where you've written something and said, no, that's never going to see publication?
There are usually a lot of steps involved that lead me to even like sit down to write in the first place. So if I have come to the page and decided to write about something, that has to mean that I've already resolved it in my actual life. I can't allow myself to like work from an active wound. I think that's not sustainable. I think that's not healthy. I think that also does not incentivize healing in any way. When I was a younger poet, that was a lot of the ways in which I was taught to approach writing poetry, where whatever is like hurting me right now is what I need to be writing about. Now I have more of an understanding of the fact that whatever is hurting me right now is not necessarily other people's business, which feels better. The poems, particularly in Girls That Never Die, but I think in general, know how to walk like a duck and talk like a duck in terms of seeming like really revelatory and personal and confessional. But to have gotten to the stage where those facts can be in poems that are then published in books, I'm all good with all that stuff now. You're never going to see any of my active wounds in my work if I can help it, because that's my business. Once I feel like I've adequately healed something where it doesn't feel like reopening a wound or reinfecting it or something for the sake of poetry, then it feels safe to make work about it in a way that doesn't feel like I'm picking my scabs or anything. I'm just from a more distant place, very interested in the things that once hurt me. And now that I'm not there anymore, it's fascinating.
So the reader shouldn't feel as if we're like reading your diary. Like these are the raw emotions the first time they're hitting the paper. Like you've worked through this stuff. You've edited, you've made decisions, like now it's ready to see the world.
Exactly. Also, I grew up with Muslim parents. I don't keep a diary. So no one will ever see my diary. It exists in my head.
There is no lock secure enough on a diary. Because of the themes in the book, I'm reading this and I'm enjoying the verse. I'm enjoying the way you're playing around with form and the themes, but I'm understanding that this book was not written for me as like a white male. It's not written for me. I really love it. I'm glad you wrote it. Who were you writing the book for? Who did you think this is who I want to read this book?
Yeah. So a lot of my work in general, I find it helpful to identify in advance who I'm writing to, or like who I want to make an offering to or whatever. Cause it just helps me feel like I'm not like writing into the void. So with this book, I am writing to a very specific community of Black, Sudanese, American, Muslim femmes that I grew up with in the DC area, who I've known since we were children. I hope other people will get something out of it, but the ideal reading experience that I imagine for someone who is not those specific people that I'm talking to is I would like for them to feel like they're maybe eavesdropping on a really interesting conversation that's not necessarily directed at them, but there's enough there that you're invested and interested.
That's good. It did feel that way. It didn't feel like voyeuristic either. It was like, this person has something to say. I think it's applicable to a more general audience, even though it wasn't, you know, written for me or people like me. But yeah, I think that comes through. There's a lot of broader truths there that have been evident in your work for a long time. So I teach Arab American Studies courses at University of Michigan. And I've used one of your videos from your college slam poetry days, I believe, to make use of water. And I use it when I'm trying to get my students to understand what it means to live in a transnational space where you're navigating multiple identities, multiple languages, physically being in multiple spaces. And I think in just like a 2-minute poem, I think that does a really good job of doing that. I felt that a lot in this book, not as directly. This book to me, sometimes I couldn't tell what space the author was physically in, which made it really interesting to try to figure out like temporality and space in each poem. But I appreciate that. I think that that's applicable to not just Arab, North African, but a lot of immigrant communities that are living in those multiple spaces.
Thank you. Yeah, I think the January Children setting wise feels like set nowhere, or like set in the in-between, or like in the absence of a place or something like that. This book, even in the writing of it, I just felt a more concrete sense of place in that I can point to specific poems, unlike in the January Children, where I can just point to specific poems and be like, I was, you know, in the void. In this book, I can point to a specific poem and be like, this is set in Cairo. This is set in Brooklyn. This is set in Oakland. This is set in Rockville, Maryland, which I think gives the poems a different sort of texture. I feel different when I'm reading them now. I feel kind of more embodied when I'm reading them, and kind of more rooted in kind of concrete memory. Whereas in the January Children, I feel more rooted in like, I don't know, like emotion and vibes. But here, I think because I was thinking more concretely about my childhood and my coming of age and things like that, I moved around a lot as a kid. And so a lot of accessing those memories was to be like, okay, where am I? I'm in Nairobi. I'm in Geneva. I'm in wherever. And so place kind of just was a tool that I kind of got to use almost for the first time, it felt like, in this book.
Play around a lot with form. And physically having to turn the book to read those, I really enjoyed that. Because as a reader, at least the way I read a book of poetry sometimes is I get too page turny. And then physically having to turn it makes you stop and think about form and think about what's happening. And then my favorite parts of poetry books, and I'm glad you included them, were the notes. Like, I love the notes. I'm an academic. That's where I live. And I could tell you were having fun constantly writing that. All these poems were coming from this 30 out of 30 or 30-30 exercise. So I'd love to hear more about that, because it seems like whatever that month was, like just something snapped in you and you said, I'm just going to write half this book in a month. So I'd like to hear about that and your choices of form and how things end up in the book that way.
Yeah. Working with inherited form and the 30-30 were both just like ways to get myself to write this book, because again, this is my second book. I had a lot of support in terms of, yes, institutional support. I was in the MFA when I was writing my first book, but also just like I felt supported by my obsessions and by my interests, and just everything I was doing was kind of feeding this book I was working on. And so obviously I got really spoiled and thought it would always be like that whenever I wanted to write a book. And it's never been like that ever since. Those couple of years after writing The January Children, most of my writing practice was just in trying to reteach myself how to write a poem and not like scare myself off. And so a lot of the early ways I was doing that was through setting myself exercises in form. I hadn't really been working with inherited forms before this. Like, I was curious about them. I liked reading them, but it just wasn't the way I was writing poetry up until that point. And what I discovered in just setting myself these kind of low stakes exercises is it was the perfect way to get my sea legs back, because then, you know, I would like write a sonnet or whatever and it would be bad. But it wouldn't be devastating in the way that writing a bad free verse poem was, because I wasn't trying to prove anything to myself about like my abilities or value as a writer or as a person. And I could just be kinder to myself and be like, hey babe, the sonnet is bad because you've never written a sonnet before. That's okay. And so I kind of just like worked my way through a bunch of forms that way. And I fell in love like with the lowering of the stakes, and also just with how generative those constraints felt to me, where I think I felt very overwhelmed at that point by the knowledge that you could do anything in a poem. And so then there just were too many tools to choose from. And I didn't know what to do. And I would sit down at a blank page and be like, you know, it's like the world's most like overwhelming and hellish buffet. So the nice thing about trying to write a Sestina or whatever is that you can only do but so many things. I felt a lot of release in that, where I didn't have to be in charge as much and I could just kind of like be a baby trying to make this bad Sestina. And it was a really fun and safe way to like write post first book poems that didn't feel like I had to prove to myself that I was still a poet or whatever.
And you were just waiting around for divine inspiration to just carry your pen across the page and there you go.
Yeah, never that. There was no divine inspiration. So many of those poems were bad, but very useful ultimately. And so a lot of the poems inform in Girls That Never Die. Some of them are revisions of some of those early ones. Most of them came later once I felt a little bit more comfortable with the form, but it felt important to kind of just have a record of one of the things that got me back into writing in this book. And then the 30-30 with Hala, I already had, I think, several drafts of this book rotting in my computer and I didn't know what to do with it. It was fine. It just was not the book that I saw in my head, but it was a book of poems for better or for worse. And then, you know, it was August 2020. We were all sitting at home.
Yeah.
Hala wrote to me and asked if I wanted to do a 30-30. I love her work. I love her. So I was happy to do it. And the reason a lot of those poems ended up making it into the book is because when I wasn't sitting down and telling myself I was writing poems for the book, there were so many more interesting things I was able to do. And the problem with all those earlier manuscripts is all the poems sounded exactly the same, because I was like, I'm writing a book about girlhood and shame. And so all the poems were exactly about girlhood and shame. And so I was just hitting the same note over and over and over and the same textures over and over and over. And it just was really frustrating in allowing myself to kind of slant away from what I had decided my themes were. Most of those poems ended up in some way or another in the book, but I needed to kind of write away from the book to like kind of loop back around and inform the book.
Yeah. So that process was, you wake up every day in August 2020 and you wake up knowing that today at some point you have to put pen to paper and write a poem.
Yes. Again, this is early pandemic. I just, you know, was looking for something to do all day. So every August, a bunch of poets on the internet do this thing called the Seely Challenge as well, where you read a book of poems every day for the month of August. I don't remember how many years old it is, but it was pioneered by the poet Nicole Seely. So this particular August, I would wake up in the morning. At some point in the early part of the day, I would read a book of poems. And then generally in the later part of the day, I would write a poem. And so it felt like this kind of tidy little ecosystem that made sense and helped not freak out too much about the world. So it was nice after a couple months of being like, what do I do all day? I've run out of stimuli. I have watched all the television there is in the world. So to just know that for a month of my life, I knew kind of more or less what I would be doing every day was very soothing for me to be like, okay, today many things can happen, but I know that I will have read a book of poems and written a poem by the end of the day. And, you know, anything beyond that is out of my hands and not my business.
And I mean, August 2020 was kind of a very eventful time in the United States. Yeah. I assume you were in the US.
Yeah,
you were
in Oakland.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot going on.
Yeah.
Did any of the contemporary conversations influence your work, or were you really trying to just be in that space? I mean, this is right after George Floyd. This is height of Trump and all this stuff. And like, so I don't know how much that you try to block all that out, or do you use that, or does that somehow make its way in?
It wasn't so much about trying to block it out, because I was very much kind of to my own detriment feeling it. But I think generally as a writer, it takes me a bit longer to metabolize the present day before it's able to show up in my work in a way that feels interesting or helpful to me. So it was almost like I was living two lives. You know, there was the kind of safe and healthy and small version of my life where I was reading a book of poems and writing a poem and emailing it to my friend and reading her poem. and I understood that world. And then there was the rest of my day where I would just doom scroll and listen to the news, and kind of the two never overlapped, which probably was for the best because it made it so that my little poetry corner was purely recreational. I didn't assign it any of the pressure of trying to make sense of or heal from the scary, painful things that were happening in my actual day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think that checks out with the process you were talking about earlier, where you're not using your poetry as a diary. And so, yeah, you need time to process things. So maybe in a few years, we'll get the poetry book about the summer of 2020 and what you were going through at that point. So another theme that I find fascinating in your work is both a theme, but then also it became a publishing convention, is the use of Arabic. And I know in your previous book, I've heard you speak about convincing the publisher to allow the Arabic script to stand untranslated, untransliterated on its own. And that shows up again in this book. And so that's fascinating to see, because I haven't seen that before, at least not so intentional. But then also just a lot of your work is about the struggles of language and either not being able to grasp an Arabic word for something or not being able to explain an Arabic concept in English. And I think, again, that makes your work very relatable to a lot of people, not just Arabic speaking folks or folks from the Arabic speaking diaspora, but anybody who's ever struggled with growing up in one language and trying to express themselves in another.
Yeah, I actually feel like in this book, I think of myself still as a writer who uses a lot of Arabic script in my poems. But relative to the other books, there isn't as much in this book. And I don't know quite why that is. It's not that it's something that I feel like I'm ready to stop doing or anything. I think a lot of the texture and the tools in this book feel different from the things that I kind of instinctively reach for. One of the things being using Arabic, but also things like caesura and lowercase and just kind of all my little tricks. I wanted to see what I could make using a new set of tools and like in what way I could still make those poems feel like mine without kind of devolving into mannerism, which I think a lot of the early drafts of the manuscript felt like that, because I kind of trapped myself by being like, well, I know how I write poetry, and then wrote a bunch of mediocre poems. So I think it's not that I will never again write a bunch of poems with Arabic in them or with caesuras in them or anything like that. I just wanted to see what I could do, like for one second, if I tried to write poems in a way that's not the way that I believe is my way of writing poems, if that makes sense. So a lot of the poems in Girls That Never Die, for the most part, with the exception of maybe like two or three, are mostly in English. A lot of them have conventional capitalization and punctuation and all sorts of spicy things that I've never used before. I think because the subject matter is kind of scary for me, my instinct would be to speak quietly and to deflect and to throw in a bunch of things that would make it harder for a reader to parse what I'm saying. And so, of course, I had to do the opposite of that and make it clear and spell it out and use conventional capitalization and punctuation and just everything I could do to not give a reader an excuse to turn away from what I was saying for any reason other than the content. You know, if the content bothers you and you want to turn away, that's fair. But if the fact that the text is hard to parse was going to be something that would turn a reader away before they got to what I was saying, then I would be letting myself off the hook in a way that I just really did not want to do this time. And so I wanted to make the poems easy to read because I know they're difficult to read, if that makes sense.
Totally. Which I guess leads me then to a similar question as you brought up subject matter and content. Is this is a combined question of both like, what can we expect from you next? But also like, are you always going to write about being Sudanese? And are you always going to write about transnational identity? Or do you find like, okay, you've settled that now more? Or is that like, that's what you do? That's your work?
You know, I will probably never know until I'm in it. But I think even in the way that like the January Children and to some extent Home Is Not a Country are about being Sudanese and being transnational and being diasporic and those things, I think Girls That Never Die is different in that that's not the central obsession. This is maybe oversimplifying or putting it crudely, but I like exercised a lot of my diaspora stuff with the January Children and Home Is Not a Country. There's a good chance I've exercised a lot of my girlhood body stuff with this book, but you know, never say never. I don't know how many books it takes. So I've like been writing like little loose poems here and there that will probably never be anywhere, which is helpful because I kind of got into this like bookmaking cycle that I need to switch my brain out of and remember that like my medium is poems. My medium is not books. And so I'm just trying to write little loose poems that have nothing to do with any book I will ever write probably. And it's nice because a lot of those poems are not really dealing with any like big lofty obsessions or concerns. They're mostly like, you know, I traveled a bunch this summer and I was walking around and observing things. And so a lot of those are just poems set in cities where I'm walking around and observing things. And it's nice to get to do a different thing. It's also nice to know that I am capable of it and I'm capable of writing poems that I like that are not always about like the enormous things that hurt me or whatever, which is not to say that I will like never again write a book about the enormous things that hurt me, but there's a good chance I might write a book about other stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
joyful things, right?
Exactly. Who knows?
Yeah. It is possible. Well, you know, I appreciate your writing and I appreciate you being here, and you have joined the elite few who have won multiple Arab American Book Awards. So that's wonderful. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And I look forward to spending some more time with you this weekend, this book award weekend, although in an effort to stay evergreen, they probably don't want me to say that, but that's okay. It works.
Every weekend is book award weekend.
Exactly. Thank you, Safia, for joining us on the Seen Gene podcast today. It was a pleasure exploring your new book with you and talking about your full body of work. And thank you to everybody out there who is listening.
Thank you for having me.
Today's episode was hosted by Matthew Jaber Stifler. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Asma Baban, and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdulhaq. Seen Gene is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Seen Gene is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, seengenepodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.